pano yasa bhagavato savaka sango tamayang bhagavantang sadamang sasangang ime hi sakare hiyatavahang avopite hiyabhipujayama sadhunobante bhagavasuchiva parinibhutopi hachima janata nukampamanasa ime sakare dugata panakalabhute patikanhatu amhakak dikaratak hitaya sukaya alahang sama sambodho bhagava buddha bhagavantang abhivademi suvakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namassami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa itipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vicacharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purissa dhamma sarati sata deva manu sanang buddho bhagava tamahang bhagavantam abhipujayami tamahang bhagavantam sirasanamami suvakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachyatang veditabo vinyuhi tamahang dhammang abhipujayami tamahang dhammang sirasanamami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho ucchupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yadidang chatari Purisa Yugadi Ata Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Sawakasango Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakhineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. May they be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again.
Here are the questions. There we go. So the first question here. Why do people need to meditate? Especially, why do non-monastic people meditate? Is it to quiet the mind, therefore increasing awareness and enhancing performance, or is it some other reason, in your opinion? Thank you and appreciate your insight. It's why people meditate. It's answered by that lovely story when a Swedish professor came to visit Ajahn Chah. In a long time ago, I was still in Thailand, so it must have been about 40 years ago, Sweden had learned that meditation had some really positive effects. So the government sent this professor, at the government's expense, to all the teachers and gurus of South and Southeast Asia and East Asia to try and find out what meditation is. And so, being a professor and being able to have standard questions and compare the results, the four questions he asked all these meditation teachers. Number one, what is meditation? Two, why do you meditate? Three, how do you meditate? And four, what do you get out of meditation? And when he came to see Ajahn Chah, because, you know, he was on a diplomatic passport, he was actually sent there by the government, Ajahn Chah received him with, you know, quite a lot of respect. And when he asked why he was there, and through the translator he had these four questions he had to ask, Ajahn Chah then asked for a paper and pencil. Mm-hmm. Now, Ajahn Chah never does that. So straight away, for those monks who live with him, you knew he was up to one of his tricks again. You're not quite sure exactly what, but this was going to be fun. And so when those questions were asked again and translated into Thai, Ajahn Chah took the paper and the pencil. He must have seen this, you know, as a kid. He scratched his head, he licked his pencil, and he wrote something down. He was acting. Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh, dear. Now it's going to get recorded. Oops. Uh-oh. So, the answer to the first question, Ajahn Chah wrote down, second question, third question, and handed it to the translator. The translator, the professor could speak English, translated into English, the venerable meditation master, the great Ajahn Chah, answer to your first question, what is meditation? His answer is, what is eating? The second question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? The third answer, how do you meditate? His answer is, how do you eat? And the fourth question, what do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? Was the great master's answer. And I remember just seeing this professor get very upset. He said, I can't take that back to my government. This is a serious question. It's not sort of a game. And I just said, that's not a game. That's all I'm giving you. They're very brilliant answers. So why do you meditate? Why do you eat? For good health and strength. And that's why you meditate. As Ajahn Chah would say later on, meditation is food for the heart. Strengthens the heart, the spiritual part of you. It's great food. And so that's why we do it. It's learning just how to be still. Is that just to get enlightenment? It has so many benefits. whether it's for your health, whether it's for your education, whether it's for stopping anxieties, whether it's for getting innovation, seeing new ways of doing things. Well, it's just so many beautiful benefits from it. And so, of course, you meditate as you're a monk, you meditate as a layperson, even kids meditate. What was over in... Many people teach meditation in schools these days. I taught meditation in school to 650 children in 1973. Way ahead of my time. Because it was the school I was a school teacher in, and every school teacher had to teach, you know, the 5 days of assembly. And the head teacher there was open enough. He said, and I said, well, I'm a Buddhist. I can't do a sort of a Christian service. He said, what can you do? I said, I can teach you meditation. He said, give it a try. So there's 650 high school kids from 11 to 17, boys and girls. They're sitting on the floor. And I said, I'm going to teach meditation now. So cross your legs. They all cross their legs. The amazing thing, they all cooperated. Which, if you know high schools, to get everyone to cooperate is amazing. And straighten your backs, you know, tuck in your chin, close your eyes, put your right hand over your left hand on your lap, and just breathe in, breathe out. For 5 minutes, they did breath meditation. And the thing I remember about that, not just they were quiet, because one of the school teachers afterwards said, what would you have done if one of the children started giggling? Because in a group, an assembly hall of 650 children, if one child had started giggling, everyone would have started giggling. But they all cooperated. And after 5 minutes, they can come out of meditation. And I always remember, just, it really touched me that I got an ovation. They clapped me afterwards. And then I'd never seen that happen in that school. Obviously, that somehow or other, that meditation touched a person, 11 years old to 17, just for 5 minutes. That's why we meditate, even as an 11-year-old kid. Would you please name the five hindrances and the defilements? Thank you. The five hindrances, even if you give them names, it's not really enough just to name them, but they're basically... It's like desire for the world of the five senses, especially the pleasures of those five senses, basically wanting stuff. And the second one is ill will, the negativity, aversion. And the third one is sloth and torpor, dullness. And the fourth one is restlessness and remorse. And the fifth one is doubt. Now, for those of you who've done many different types of meditation, especially those of you who've done vipassana retreats, especially if you think you're practicing satipatthana meditation. In satipatthana meditation, those four focuses of mindfulness on the body, on experience, what sometimes people call feeling, Vedana, I prefer experience, the mind, and you know, some of the mind objects, or dhammas, when you're doing that, prerequisite, what you have to do before you even start doing the satipatthana practice, is in Pali, vinaye loke abhijja dhammasang. And that Pali, I'm only saying this because, you know, to impress upon people, I know what I'm talking about. I don't just write funny stories and tell jokes. I know my Pali and my suttas. And what that means is having restrained. And what it usually says is grief and covetousness for the world. And when I saw that, that didn't make any sense. You studied a bit deeper and you found in both the commentaries to the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya and the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, both times it means having restrained the five hindrances.
Lokeya Bija is a synonym for Kamachanda, the first of those five hindrances. Domanasa, twice in two suttas, is a synonym for Vyapada, ill will. And the commentaries recognize that and they say this means having restrained, basically having calmed most of the five hindrances before you start Satipatthana. Otherwise, if you want too much, you can't really focus on anything. Too much ill will, of course you can't focus. Sloth and torpor, where did that come from anyway? Too much effort. Restlessness and remorse, because you haven't got enough joy in what you're doing. And doubt, your mind is not strong enough. Not enough power, what I'm saying this morning, the power of mindfulness. So if you're going to do vipassana, you can't really do vipassana, but you know they say that. If you're going to practice vipassana and see things as they truly are, those five hindrances have to be suppressed, first of all. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So that's what the five hindrances, they're a very important part of the practice. And the defilements. There's no end of defilements, but usually say you're mostly greed, hate, and delusion, if you like, or like wanting, and even resistance. And I prefer delusion rather than ignorance, because delusion is not seeing things which are really there. The best example of this, which I'm now going to give you, it's one of my favourites, coming from my good friend Bernard Carr, one of the close disciples of Stephen Hawking's and a good mate of mine, and he was also, until I think probably still is, the treasurer of the London Psychic Research Society. We used to go ghost hunting together when I was a student with Bernard, and now he became the Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London. And every now and again we catch up with him. And he came to our conference we had here some years ago, a global conference on Buddhism. But anyway, an experiment which was done at Imperial College London. One of his friends, top scientist, brought a flower pot into the lecture theatre. And he'd already advertised that he was going to demonstrate levitation. Now, this was not a crazy fellow. This was one of the top scientists in England. He said he was going to demonstrate levitation in front of all his peers, other sort of great scientists, professors, experimenters, and to make sure that there was no funny business. He had cameras all over the place, infrared cameras, ultraviolet cameras, still cameras, because if it worked, he wanted some evidence it actually happened. So he came in carrying the flower pot, so there's no wires or anything, and he put the flower pot on the bench, and he said, in order to create the right atmosphere to levitate this flower pot, I need all of you to start chanting the Indian holy word, Om. And I don't know how he managed to do this, but all these old, crusty old professors, conservative, they started chanting Om. Om, Om, Om. Come on, you try it, come on. Om. Okay, enough. But as they were chanting Om, the flower pot rose up into the air. It actually levitated. And they caught it on cameras, they photographed it, they videoed it. And afterwards, they asked all the professors, what they saw. And several of them said, it never levitated. It was on the bench all the time. Look, here's the video. Oh, that was just fake. Said, I was there with my own eyes, it never levitated. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment. The truth of the matter was, this was Imperial College London. They had managed to install this really powerful electromagnet under the bench. And when they turned on the current, very large currents, which was needed to actually to lift that flower pot, they always have the humming sound. And they needed everyone to go om, 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 to mask the fact that it was an electric current suddenly being turned on. Otherwise, they'd have figured out it was a trick. But the purpose of the experiment was that even though the flower pot levitated, some people would not see it. That's what delusion is. Something is really happening, but it doesn't even reach your conscious awareness. It gets filtered out, even though it's actually happening. You just don't see it. Anything which challenges you, challenges your narrative, challenges your worldview, you just cannot see it. It's filtered out by a delusion. Sometimes you call it denial. Sometimes you call it wishful thinking. How much of reality do we create? How much do we deny? It's there. We just cannot see it. That's one of the reasons why the only time you can really trust what you experience is when those five hindrances have been suppressed, when you're not bending the truth to suit yourself. That's the importance of the five hindrances. Otherwise, people will just, they'll say, I saw it, it happened. Well, no, of course it didn't happen, I saw it, I'm an experimental physicist, I'm trained to observe. No. If it's something which challenges you very deeply, you just don't see it. That is why, to get wisdom, to make sure that what you're experiencing, what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're feeling, what you're knowing, is reliable, we have to suppress the five hindrances. They're the things which actually distort reality to suit us. That's why people have arguments. We all think we're right. Can we all be right? Or is it somehow we're distorting reality? The next question. Dear Ajahn, as well as breath meditation, can we also do body scanning meditation? Yes, of course you can. You know, sometimes that people, they start off with like breath meditation. If they can't do breath meditation, then I usually teach them Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them like body scanning. If they can't do body scanning, maybe I teach them metta meditation. If they can't do metta meditation, I teach them loving kindness meditation. If they can't do loving kindness meditation, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they don't realize that's what they started on. And I say that because all the meditations are the same. It's all about learning how to let go, to be still, to empower the mind. With stillness, you wake up, and you can see things without the five hindrances. Your mind becomes powerful, and you can see things what you want to see. Truth, which sometimes challenges you. But if you're somebody who is a real experiment, are you really devoted to seeing the truth? Not what is comfortable, but what's really there. Then you could see it. A good example of that is cancers. Breast cancers, prostate cancers, other skin cancers. Why is it that people can't see them? They're there, but you know, admitting you've got a cancer, that's really scary. This is one of the reasons why people are always in denial. You just don't see it until it's a bit late. Why? Because admitting that it's there is really quite challenging for a person. So, denial. You can see so many examples of denial in your life. So, yeah, you can do all this body scanning meditation, breath meditation, loving kindness meditation. There's many other types of meditation, and I'll teach many of them, but they're all really the same. But it's good fun to be able to do different ones. It's all pretty much the same, but because it's like looks like variety, and you think it's the same, What was it that when I was Christmas time as a student years ago, we used to have this really, you know, quite a nice job for the students to help in the post office with the Christmas mail. In the days before email, people would send Christmas cards to their relations and friends. So there was a huge increase in mail to be sorted, to be posted at the post office for about 2 or 3 months of the year, or 2 or 3 weeks of the year. It coincided with school or university holidays, so you got a job in the post office over Christmas. And I remember just a post office fellow in charge, one of the people who were there all the time, he gave me the bag and said, can you go to the front of the post office there to empty the post box? There was actually 3 post boxes there, post box. So, you know, they had like slits. One was for local mail, one was for national mail outside of London, and the other slit was for international mail. And I said, well, isn't there 3 keys? No, it's only just 1 key. And I saw all these people just, you know, looking at their mail, making sure it went into the right slot. But then actually when I opened up, they all went in the same basket. I said, why do you do that for? He said, well, we've done it for a long time, we just have to sort them out anyway. People put them in the wrong compartments anyway, so we just have them there and just all go in the same basket. So that's the same as meditation. You may think mindfulness meditation or vipassana or samatha or metta are different. They're not. They just all go into the same basket to get sorted. Due to health problems, I've been upset and angry in recent years, which makes it difficult to become peaceful in meditation. What can I do about this? Health problems? The health problems, it depends what type of, if it's mental health or physical health or both. If it's physical health, it's no problem. Just have to get the correct type of meditation. Even mental health problems, just get the right type of meditation. So one of those types of meditation, okay. You asked about different types of meditation, all the same, but sometimes a different aspect to it. This is what I call the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. I love this, I do it myself. And the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, you might probably, I hope, you've all remembered that story which I wrote in Opening the Door of Your Heart. An emperor had it up to here with organized religion. They're always arguing and who was right and who was wrong and creating sort of problems in the kingdom and conflict. And so he decided to invent his own religion. It was a story from Tolstoy. And he decided he needed 3 questions answered. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person, and what's the most important thing to do? Okay, and how many of you have read that, remember that story? Put your hand up. Well, only half of you. Okay, those put your hand up, you have to be quiet. Okay, shh. Those who haven't heard that story before, what answers do you suggest? When is the most important time? Yeah, of course, so that's part of all meditation. Now is the only time you have. Forget about later on or what happened earlier. Now is the only time you ever have. Who is the most important person? Ha 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 ha, you're wrong. Yay. I don't know why I get sadistic joy out of asking that question when I know people will say me. No, that's not the correct answer. That's the answer I thought when I first read this as a student. It's one of these things you read which, you know, change you so much. Change the way you look at things. I was just walking around thinking, wow, that's amazing. I never thought like that before. The most important person is the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. And straight away, wow, how often I felt rejected. You know, especially just after a lecture, I was at Cambridge at the time, you'd go up to the lecturer and you had an interesting question, you'd ask him. He wasn't paying attention. He just wanted to get rid of you. I was only a student, long hair, and I wasn't important to him. And you felt rejected. I was right in front of him, but I certainly was not the most important person in the world. And of course, you know, the relationships you have with someone, your husband, your wife, your kids, parents. How often is that the case? You come home and you tell your partner, oh, I had a wonderful, and they're not listening to you. they want to go off and just, you know, to have a phone call with someone or something. They're not giving you importance. You're right in front of them, and you feel you're not the most important person in the world at all. They take you for granted. And of course, that's amazing. I was going to say that I taught this in Cathay Pacific, and the HR boss at Cathay Pacific thought that was so good, he introduced that into his training program. But unfortunately, Cathay Pacific, the Hong Kong airline, is not doing all that good these days. So I don't know why I should actually say that that's, I taught that. But it was working well at the time. So anyway, the one in front is the most important. What's the most important thing to do? Well, that was to care. And the story behind that, and I'm telling the story, it's early, so I usually spend so much time telling stories, but this is a very good one. The Sri Lankan doctor, grown up at sort of our city centre, that was Nirangela's son, Sri Nirangela Sumata. And he came to see me one Saturday, telling me that, now he was a resident, and he said, I can't sort of do this job anymore. I have to resign. After all that hard work, you know, training, studying, passing his exams, and now he's going to give it up. I said, why? And that was the case that one of his patients had died tragically. And it was his patient. He didn't see the real problem. And no one could. It wasn't his fault. But it was tragedy because it was a girl about 23 years of age, young, and he had to go and tell her husband that the woman he'd married, committed to, was no more. She died, and it was unexpected. And even to make it worse, the two little children standing with him say, you got no mummy anymore. Mummy's dead. And that hurt him so badly, as you could understand. And he had to be the one who told them that. And he felt, even though, you know, he didn't, no one could blame him, but nevertheless, you feel guilty. And he said, if I have to do this ever again, I just can't stand it. I have to find some other profession. Anything. I can't be a doctor. I felt I've failed the family. And myself. And that's when I sort of told him, I said, look, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor, or being a nurse, or being a therapist, or being a monk, or being anybody who cares about others. Your job is not to cure. If you think you have to cure, then you'll fail many times in your life as a doctor. But if you understand your job, your main priority is to care, you never need to fail. You can always care, but you can't always cure. So any patient who comes to see you, care for them. And you'll make that your main priority, and you'll never fail at all. And even if the patient dies, the whole family realized they were cared for, the whole lot were cared for, and they will recognize that. And also, if you make caring more important than curing, I said, and this was just my intuition, but he confirms it. If you make caring more important than curing, you get many more people cured by other means. Because care is a great therapy. So he did that, and so from there, I just used that little anecdote of why caring is more important than curing. You may have a partner who drives you crazy. Don't try and cure him or her of irritating behavior. Care for them. And then the irritating behavior goes. You may have a boss at work. It's like a boss from hell. So, you don't try and cure them of their bad behavior or their bad speech. Care for them. And then the bad speech finishes. You may have defilements in your meditation. Are you going to try and cure your defilements? Or are you going to try and care for them? If you care for them, they go much quicker. So, that is... So if you have like health problems, for goodness sake, don't cure them. Care for them. Totally different ball game. I don't know why the people can't see that. It was the story of the anger-eating monster, another great story. These stories, you remember these, and so you apply them, and it just solves so many problems in meditation. The anger-eating monster, an empress, was out on a meditation retreat. You never know who's actually on this meditation retreat. Sometimes I get to know who's on this meditation retreat, because I know that sometimes you get supermodels come on this meditation retreat. And I always know a supermodel's here because you get an unexpected number of young men come on a retreat. Never seen them in the temple before. This has happened. But there was a Thai supermodel came on one of my retreats when we had it in North Perth. And I didn't know her. I don't know sort of Thai movies and stuff. But she's a supermodel actress. And the only reason I knew is that all these young Thai boys were coming. Hardly ever see them meditate in the temple. But they're all coming on a retreat. I said, wow, what are they doing here? I said, don't you know, there's a very famous, beautiful Thai actress over there. And that's all they came for. Oh, well, never mind. Anything to get people to meditate. So anyway, what was that? Oh, yeah. So the Empress was at the retreat. And when she went back to her palace, she found when, in her absence, this big monster had gone into her palace. This monster was huge, frightening, so scary that all of the security and the soldiers and the guards, they went and hid in the cupboards. They went and crouched behind the flower pots. And they just, under the tables, they were so scared they hid instead of protecting the palace, allowing the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the empress's chair. And that was too much. So the soldiers came out and said, get out now. That's not your chair. That's our empress's chair. You've got no right to sit there. You may be big, but there's many of us. Get out now. And of those few unkind words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more scary, more smelly. And at that, the more guards came out. They got out their swords, their sticks, and they threatened and threatened, but every unkind word, deed, or thought, the monster got bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time the empress came back, this monster was huge and was so scary, would make even like alien. People said that's the most scary of monsters created by Hollywood. Would make alien look like a little teddy bear. And so smelly. Oh, thank you, somebody, for laughing. It was so stinky that even the maggots crawling on its skin threw up. They couldn't stand the smell. And as soon as the Empress saw this, what did she do? Welcome, monster. Has anyone got you something to drink here? It's a hot day. Do you want a glass of water? How about some orange juice? Oh, I got some lovely carrot juice today. Do you want some carrot juice? How about something to eat? You know, I know you're a big person, a monster. Would you like to have, like, a pizza? Because they have them in monster sizes. Monster-sized pizza for you. And, no, it wasn't just a joke. She was actually just really kind and compassionate to this huge monster. And every kind word, kind deed, or kind thought, the monster just grew an inch smaller. Less smelly, less ugly, and less violent. And everybody in the palace realized their faults. And they realized why this woman was the empress. She was really smart. And so they all started being kind to the monster, caring for the defiled monster in the palace. Someone gave it foot, no, not one, about 24 soldiers gave him a foot massage. Imagine how big the feet are. A few others gave him a neck massage, his huge head. No wonder he had a sore neck and shoulders. And they were so kind to this monster, before the pizza came, he was so small that one more act of kindness and vanished completely away. It's called the anger-eating monster story. Based on a story in the suttas with a lot of embellishments by yours truly. There was no mention of pizzas or teddy bears in the suttas. But that was the main part of the story. And that is why caring can overcome defilements, where anger and ill will get out of here. Anger, you don't belong. So those are the three answers to the three emperor's questions. The best time is now, and the most important person is the one right in front of you. The most important thing to do is to care. So what's that got to do with meditation? You've got health problems, you're tired, you're sick, or you're really in fever, or you're dying. When you're in that sort of state, what's the most important time? Now, you're here. What's the most important meditation object? Whatever's right in front of you when you close your eyes. The pain, the ache, the fear, whatever it is, the sickness, the tiredness, the fever, if that's right in front of you right now, as you close your eyes, that is the most important thing in the world. So that means you're mindful of it. You're not trying to get rid of it to try and watch something else. It's here, it's now, give it importance. You don't try and cure it. That's negativity, getting rid of it. You care for it. When you care for the monsters of sickness, it's amazing just how they start to shrink. Every time you care, they get less important. Because many sicknesses, if not all sicknesses, are anger-eating demons. So that means you can always meditate. Yeah, got insomnia, you can't sleep at night, laying in your bed, that's the most important time, closing your eyes, this feeling of insomnia, no matter what it is, what is it? It's here. Be mindful of it. It's important. Give it importance. And don't try and cure it. Care for it.
Do you mean if you sick, you don't need to see a doctor?
Oh, yeah, if there's a doctor around.
But this is a cure.
It's a cure. It depends what. The best doctor is Dr. Brahm. I mean, if you've broken your leg or got a snake bite, please care for this temple too, because we can't afford the insurance if something goes wrong. So be sensible. So care. Anyway, is it okay to listen to the talks of Sadhguru on meditation? I am not that body and not even that mind. I'm not anything. So who are you? Even saying, who are you? It's assuming you are something, but you haven't quite found out what that is yet. So, it's instead of saying, I am not the body, not even that mind, you just ask, what do I take myself to be? What do I assume myself to be? And have enough deep meditation to have those five hindrances disappear first. So you can be reliable that what you see of answers to that question is not answering the question to suit your own theories or your own beliefs. You're answering the questions to suit reality. With no fear. Because your hindrances are gone. Sometimes those questions can be very interesting, but you still don't get the right answers until those hindrances are totally gone. Will the nuns be doing guided meditations this time? I really enjoyed the guided meditations last time. But it's not the same nuns, is it? Is it? Confess? No, see, so not the same nuns. Not the same guided meditations. They may look the same. Actually, sometimes, is that the case? They all look the same, nuns? No. No, of course they look different. It's up to them, so if you really want to ask them, please make that request. Do a guided meditation. When? When did they do it last time? It was in the afternoon, wasn't it? Aha, so I know who asked this question. Okay, well, it's up to... Do any of you come in the afternoon instead of the interviews? 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock? You can take turns doing it, if you need to. Anyway, you can tell me later on, if you want to. Are the jhana states that North American teachers lead students into the real thing? Former monks, they make it sound so easy. Sometimes they call it jhana light, L-I-T-E, which means it's not the real thing, but they make it sound like the real thing. If it's a jhana, you can't mistake that. That's powerful, that's huge. And afterwards, you're just happy for hours. One of the ways, which if somebody says they've just achieved a jhana, I look at them and say to them, I'm sorry, women can't achieve jhanas. And I look at them. And if they get upset, I say, no, okay, that wasn't a jhana. Of course women can get jhanas. I'm just trying to wind you up to see if I get a reaction. And if I get a reaction, that wasn't a jhana. Skillful means. Well, maybe it's unskillful means, I don't know. But it's a means anyway to find out. So, of course, many women get jhanas. But the point was that it was just, if you just had a jhana, you are just like you're in love. You know, like you're blissing out. It's this most powerful experience. And, having a wonderful time. So one of the points is that after getting those jhanas, the five hindrances just can't come up for a long time. So like ill will just can't come up. That's why you try and get people to, you know, say, nah, that's not a jhana. And I'm just listening to see what your reaction is. Actually, I'm telling you all my tricks. I shouldn't tell you those tricks, so I'm not going to find. I've got some other tricks anyway. You know, for years, that people didn't teach jhanas, they thought they weren't necessary, or they actually tried to stop jhanas being taught. And it was monks like me, just, I think they had a saying in Christianity, fools go in where angels fear to dread. So that's me, I always go in there and just try and change things, make them better. But then, I realized that's how Buddhism should be taught. Jhanas are right there, they're important to meditation. Why not? People can get jhanas, lay people can get jhanas, all sorts of people get jhanas. And this one fellow I always like to mention, who came here 2 or 3 years ago, and Ajahn Brahm's stereotyping. So I was actually just around the office when he came to check in, to register, and he was this big Australian guy, shorts and singlet, full Australian national dress, and tattoos all over him. And as soon as the big fella, as soon as he came, he looked really rough. And so I said, excuse me, sir, I think you've got the wrong place. Carnot Prison is up the road. Totally stereotyped. I don't know why I did that, but I'm glad I did, because it was part of a good story. And then, he said, no, I'm on a retreat. And I'd never seen him before, but his name was down there. I said, okay, welcome. And he was the one. After 4 or 5 days, he came for his interview, and I listened to what he was saying. Wow, you just had a jhana. And I don't say that easily. I have a very, very strict sort of requirements to telling a person that was a jhana, and he got it. He was a star meditator. And that really put me in my place. I can't judge who gets them, who doesn't get them, who's going to and who's not going to. And sometimes I get totally just... the word is discombobulated. I never thought that person would get it, of all the people here, but they're the ones who do. So, that could be you. If you haven't got a jhana yet, get some tattoos. That's only a joke. Don't do that. It doesn't have any difference. So anyway. But anyway, that was a time when people said you shouldn't do jhanas. And I come, no, of course, you have to be able to teach people jhanas, lay people as well as monks. Because in the time of the Buddha, lay people, all people got jhanas. And so why not? So you make it open for people. But as soon as I start talking about jhanas, they're in incredible states. There's a problem. People want them. The craving is very strong for them. You may think you're not really craving them, but look, they're amazing states. So yeah, we want them. And that's where, to satisfy our desires, we lower the standards. So, you know, people can think they achieve them. Anyway, does our past life parami impact the current meditation progress? Of course. Some people can easily meditate, but some others are quite difficult. Of course, yeah. There's this one six-year-old kid, or six, maybe seven-year-old kid, and he got this jhana while his father was doing a ceremony, and he was sitting under, this little kid was sitting under a rose apple tree. You know that was the Buddha in there. Before he was enlightened. And of course, the Buddha before he was enlightened, what was one of his previous lives? It's in the Gatikara Sutta. One of his previous lives was Jyotipala, who became a monk under Kassapa, the Buddha. And that was our Siddhartha Gautama. So he had some amazing previous lives. One of his previous lives was under the previous Buddha, Kassapa, the Buddha. Ooh. So he had some pretty good parami. But the thing is, some people say, oh yeah, my meditation is quite difficult. That must be that I haven't got much good karma in the past. And people say, oh, sadhu, 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 you remember your past lives? That's amazing. And I don't remember my past life. How do you know? Give it a try. You don't know. Maybe you can get meditation easy. Just get the right teacher, the right sort of place, the right instructions, and you're off, you're away. Dear Ajahn Brahm, people know about meditation and its value. Why is it so difficult to get people to do it? How best can we encourage more people to do it? Of course, the only way to encourage more people to do it is for you to do it yourself and make an impression on others. In other words, like this one lady from Sydney a few years ago, she came here, she said she had to beg, grovel to her boss to get time off to come on a retreat. But when she went back to Sydney at the end of the retreat, she sent this email to me. My boss, when he saw me at work on a Monday morning, he said, what drug have they been giving you at Jhana Grove? I don't care what it is, but please bring me back some next time. In other words, the boss realized, no drugs obviously, but the boss realized there was a huge change in his assistant and saw it. And of course, that is how we let other people do some meditation. When they see its effect on you, of course, they will want to try some meditation. But, you know, one of the problems is getting decent teachers and decent places. For those of you who've been to other meditation retreat centres, you know, look at this place. You know, you get your own room with your own ensuite. How many meditation centres in the world are like that? You have to be in a dormitory. And in a dormitory, there's always someone who snores. So you can't get a good night's sleep. You know, and sometimes, you know, the food is not good for you, so you have to just be in the toilet and have diarrhea or something. So we really put a lot of effort into making this comfortable for you. So more and more people can want to meditate. They're not afraid of meditation. But some people, they tell me that no, they don't want to go to the very strict Vipassana retreats where they've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning whether you like to or not. If you're sick, they drag you from your room. Literally. And they sit you down. And 50 minutes of sitting or 45 minutes and then gong, 50 minutes of walking, gong, 45 minutes of sitting, gong, 15 minutes of walking, gong, half an hour of eating, gong. It drives you crazy. No wonder some people would like that discipline, but for others, it really does drive them crazy. It's just too forceful. And they hear that, and most people say, I don't want to do that. But they come on, Ajahn Brahm's nice, kind, peaceful retreat. If you feel tired, you don't have to get up in the morning, you can sit there in your room. You know, you can get some nice food. You can just have a nice cup of tea in the afternoon and watch the trees grow. You can go for a walk in the forest. And you tell jokes as well. Have you heard about the man who went to the psychologist? And he said, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. Other times I think I'm a teepee. You know, the wigwam. And the psychologist said, oh yeah, I know your problem. Very common these days. You're too tense. Now, I say those jokes on purpose because they actually make people relax. The laughter, you know, lessens the tiredness and even the aches and pains in the body. It's a very skillful means. So that's why the people come here and they get some good jokes. Oh, sorry, no, bad jokes. But they have a lot of happiness, and that happiness transfers into deep meditation. Anyway, are we allowed to do fire kusina meditation using a candle in our rooms? No, it's fire season now. Do you want to have bushfires like they have in South Australia and Sydney and Melbourne? No, of course not. Anything else but fire kusinas, because crikey, that will really... Because sometimes people just let those candles just keep on. You might get into jhanas and then the candle just falls over and just burns the whole building down and then the jhana grove and then me and then everybody else. Well, you'll never be allowed back again. So no, just be careful with the fires. And there's many other things you can do. So fire kusina, not a good idea. This is one of the dangers in this bush. Everything else is just really safe here. The only one danger, especially this time of the year, is bushfires. As many of you see on the news. So make sure that you don't use any naked flames anywhere, sort of on the premises. Except in the kitchen, obviously, to cook. Does one of the nuns mind giving guided meditation in the afternoon? My goodness, the pressure is building. Should someone really serious about meditation give up listening to music? Thanks. Depends what type of music. So, if you're really, how serious you are on meditating. Because sometimes people who get stressed out at work, sometimes I do encourage them. Just when you get home, instead of just sitting down trying to meditate straight away, it's just too big a transition from the busyness of work, you know, to being quiet in meditation. So sometimes even listening to some soft, calm music or nature music or something, sometimes that can just calm you down and get into the mood to meditate. If it's listening to rock and roll, yeah, that's not a good idea to do when you're meditating. Otherwise, you may be just dancing up and down when you're just doing the walking meditation. But other than that, it's usually, depends what type of music, basically. Dear Ajahn, in other religions, they practice various rituals like baptism or circumcision to call them followers of that particular faith. How does one become a Buddhist? My goodness, if it was circumcision, we'd have nobody. Oh, sometimes I'm a very naughty monk. That sometimes there was this. He was that. Remember James? James, he was the son of the one of the rangers here, the head ranger. So, you know, he comes around every now and again, stays for a few days. And, yeah, very helpful fellow, but a bit sort of accident prone. So he said one day, he said, no, I really want to be an Anagarika. What do I have to do? I said, oh, circumcision. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want to, I'm only joking. We don't have circumcision. I could, Because he didn't have much understanding what it's like being a Buddhist. So no, you don't have to circumcise yourself. Or baptism. No. If you want to be a Buddhist, you just go for refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. That's all, very simple. But anyway, a lot of people, they don't actually do a ceremony to become a Buddhist. Just many people have a similar experience that I had. At 16, first school prize. And so I was told to get by my teacher, go get some books on maths. So that way you can even do better next year. So I dutifully went to the bookshop and get books on maths. They were so boring. You get those from the school library. That was the school's job to teach you about maths. And I wasn't going to waste my first school prize on that. So this was Foyle's bookshop in Charing Cross Road. So on the opposite side of the road, in the annex, on the attic, the top floor, were all like the kind of forbidden books. So the one I got for my school prize was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Not because I was interested in it, but because I thought it was a really cool title. So the headmaster had to present me with the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But anyway, so I started reading some of these books on Buddhism, and when I sort of started reading them, actually they made sense. So I decided, yeah, I never got converted, that's what I was, all along, but didn't know it. So I didn't really take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha to be a Buddhist. I'd already taken that refuge without even knowing a monk. So, you know, that's a very common, obviously from previous lives. The first time I saw a monk, and many other people have the same experience, wow, that was something really important. You know, you were just really amazed to see a real Buddhist monk. So, it is important. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, I have not been able to relax my body as thought I could. I'm still experiencing a tight thigh muscles, lower back tension. I try to explore relaxating by letting go in my mind and find comfortable positions. I haven't had much progress or improvement to make my body comfortable. Is this because I'm forcing my mind to relax, or do you have any suggestions that help relax the body? Thank you in advance for responding to my query. Yeah, just go to bed and stretch in the bed. You can meditate in your bed if you have a sore body. But if you do meditate on the bed, try and find a position where you don't normally go to sleep. Now, because I read this years ago that the Buddha went to sleep on his right side, so I've been 45 years as a monk, I've just done that. So I just go to sleep on my right side. Sometimes the left side if I turn over, but it's always on my side. And I never go to sleep on my back. So I've kept that back posture. If I lay flat on my back, that is my meditation posture. And because I've been doing that for such a long time, it's like my brain realizes that this is not the posture to go to sleep when I'm on my back. I have to be on my side to go to sleep. I reserve some postures for sleeping and some postures, you know, for meditating. So if I want to meditate on my bed, stretch out and just meditate on my back. So try that. And if you have really achy legs, do some walking meditation, which is also good. Get some exercise. And that might help. So that can be ways of finding comfortable positions. And if none of those work, remember you can always try the Emperor's Three Questions. You're sitting down or lying down or walking and say, what am I aware of right now? Whatever this is the most important thing in the world. It may be the ache in your thigh. And I'm not going to try and cure it, I'm going to care for it. Don't try and watch the breath or watch the movement in your legs or whatever. Just be with the feeling which is the most prominent. It's coming up because it's supposed to be teaching you something. It'll keep coming up again until you learn its lesson. So sometimes I just stop. Whatever's in front of me right now is really important. I'm not going to try and watch the breath or get nimitters, itchy nose. That's the most important. I learn from it, and I care for it. Last question. I'm wondering how we can be more inclusive or diverse of diverse groups and be inviting underprivileged. That's underprivileged. We are underprivileged. Nuns are underprivileged. Are you underprivileged? I don't get any salary. I don't get any superannuation. I can't retire because I've got no pension. Does that count as underprivileged? I don't even have a place to stay. I just sleep on the floor in my cave. No one feeds me in the evening. Am I underprivileged? Okay, anyway, I know what you're saying. Underprivileged, unseen groups of people. I'm thinking in particular of indigenous people groups, saying anyone can attend retreats isn't enough. We need to make an extra effort. Perhaps we could start by having this conversation and have indigenous flags at the centre. Could do. But sometimes, as what I know, is that some of the indigenous people have their own cultural forms of meditation. In other words, that are they underprivileged? Or are we underprivileged? So anyway, we'll see how we can answer that question. I'm not sure. There's very few indigenous groups around this area. When we first got this Jhana Grove property, we did ask the indigenous Noongars to see whether there was any sacred sites here. But they said no. They would travel on the top of the scarp or down the bottom, but not along sort of the edges of the scarp where we are right now. Okay, yes.
Rajan, can you please follow this question? Can you please describe the feeling you have nothing?
Sorry, Lee?
Can you describe the feeling you have nothing?
I have nothing.
Yeah.
The feeling?
Yeah. I have nothing. How do you feel?
How do I feel when I have nothing? Free! Is that the question you mean?
Yes.
Whenever you have something, you have something to protect, something to own, something to look after, something to clean, something to be taxed and declare on your tax form. It's great when you have nothing. What was it that 2 years ago I decided to go and get a Commonwealth Seniors Healthcare Card? The only reason was because I could. Don't need it. But anyway, I did. So I went over to online first of all, but apparently that wasn't good enough. I needed to show up at the Centrelink offices in Armidale to prove who I was. Because, there's such a thing as identity fraud. So I went up made an appointment, went up to Centrelink in Armidale, and when I just was sitting in front of this lady who was interviewing me, she said, "Can you please prove who you are?" And I said, "For 45 years I've been trying to answer that question. Haven't found an answer yet." And she never thought it was funny. Said, "No, ID, documentation." And so I've got a passport. No, that's good, that's a start. Now what about your driving license? I don't have a driving license. What about your credit card? Don't have a credit card. What about your bank account? Don't have a bank account. What about your rental agreement? Don't have a rental agreement. A home ownership? No, don't own a home. And the next thing they asked me, really honest, they said, "Do you have a marriage license? A marriage certificate or whatever?" So I don't have one of those either. It's amazing they think I'd have a marriage license. And then when they went through all these things, they said, "Well, as far as Centrelink, the government, is concerned, you don't exist." I said, "Yeah, the Buddha was right." Even Centrelink agrees. And the only way I could get this card, because I had two passports, you know, the British passport as well. I thought, okay, that's good enough. So otherwise, I wouldn't have got I wouldn't exist. Isn't that nice, not to exist, to be off the grid? Anyway, so there we go. Who are you? You are Centrelink. That's their problem. Very good. Okay, so I think that's enough for the night. It's 9 o'clock. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.